Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, October 3rd, 2017. There's renewed fighting between rebel and government forces, this time in Biad State.
All the attacks were repelled with very heavy casualties. We had some casualties on both sides.
And South Sudanese who violate child labor laws in WOW are put on notice.
Anybody found using children to deliver to water by water katungi, his crime will be more, and he or she will first be punished selling water expensively and secondly for using a child.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Four government soldiers and 20 rebels were reportedly killed over the weekend during fighting between government and rebel forces loyal to Riek Machar in Biad State. The UN mission in South Sudan says its peacekeepers are not able to access the area due to the ongoing fighting. Waki Simon Mudu reports for VOA from Juba.
SPLA spokesman Brigadier General Lul Ruai Kwang told the reporters at a news conference in Juba on Monday that rebel forces attacked government positions in Biad State's water village on Sunday and the fighting continues in the area.
The attack came from the eastern part of Wata. It went on for over 1 hour and the attackers were repelled. There was a second attack which was launched at around 10. It also lasted for over an hour. It was launched from the northern part of Wat. All the attacks were repelled with very heavy casualties. We had some casualties on both sides.
Kwang also says a radio message intercepted by the South Sudan Army indicated a total of 91 rebel fighters were killed and 40 others were wounded. The SPLA spokesman blames Machar's forces for starting the battle.
We are also taking this opportunity to tell the people of South Sudan that Riek Machar is trying to blackmail him. He's not at the political scene. He's not on the ground commanding his troops, but he's using his combat area in South Africa to cause problems back at home. It is well calculated for him, but I don't think it is going to change any direction or the course the events are taking.
Colonel Lampol Gabriele, the spokesman of the SPLAIO, led by Riek Machar, confirms his forces attacked government positions in Wat village and claims they now control most of Wat. But Colonel Gabriele denied losing any rebel fighters in the battle.
If they killed 90, how then are we in their trenches at the moment? Because if you killed 90, then you should have driven us out of Wat. But we are in Wat and we are in control, three-quarters of Wat at the moment, and we are in their barracks.
Kwang says the rebels sold a plane belonging to the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, that was sent to airlift wounded soldiers out of Wat yesterday. He alleges the plane's pilot was forced to leave without carrying a single wounded soldier. Colonel Gabriel denies the claim. The United Nations mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, confirms the fighting took place but could not outline details. Spokesman Daniel Dickinson says UNMISS is waiting for the government to give them the go-ahead to access the area.
You know, the fighting is ongoing, so we would only seek to go there once the fighting is over and once we're given the requisite permissions to travel there.
The fighting is the latest violation of the cessation of hostilities signed by the warring parties in August 2015. The UN Security Council has repeatedly called on South Sudan's warring parties to end the fighting and implement the fragile 2015 peace deal. Nikki Haley, the U.S. permanent representative to the United Nations, plans to travel to South Sudan later this month to urge President Salva Kiir to silence the guns and participate in the IGAD forum, which is aimed at reviving the 2015 peace agreement and making sure it is fully implemented. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
South South Sudan's ongoing conflict and economic crisis has forced many children into child labor. Authorities in Wau Town say they have seen a rise in the number of children working in restaurants or selling water. The Wau Town mayoress, Celestina Livio Bahara, is warning businesses against employing children. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Children between the ages of 12 and 14 are a source of cheap labor in Wau Town. Some business-minded residents use the children to fetch water from the nearby rivers or wells and sell it to residents in the various outlying areas of Wau Town. Other children wash cars, wash dishes in restaurant kitchens, or polish shoes on the street to help earn money for their parents trying to put food on the table. He's speaking in Arabic, a 14-year boy in Wau named Wall says he works carrying a water cart and is paid 40 South Sudanese pounds per trip. He says they are staying in Wau Catholic Church. He has no shoes or school uniform. Wall says a friend usually asks him to pull the cart and pays him 40 South Sudanese pounds for each trip. He says he can collect water 5 to 6 times a day. Another water carrier, 12-year-old Anthony, says his boss underpays him. He makes 30 South Sudanese pounds per trip from the river to the residential areas. Speaking in Arabic, Anthony says his mother told him to do the work so he can help provide food for the family. I am not in school, Anthony says. He says he usually collects water from the well and sells it to make some money, which he uses to buy food. My father is not here, but in Juba, Anthony says. Anthony says he is willing to go to school if his mother is able to provide food for the family. Wau Municipal Mayor Celestina Livio Bahara issued an order last week banning the use of children as water fenders. Speaking in Arabic, Bahara says anyone employing children will be arrested and punished.
Anybody found using children to deliver water by water cart donkey, his crime will be more, and he or she will first be punished selling water expensively and secondly for using a child whose age is less than 18. He or she will face the law, and the municipal authority will confiscate the donkey and the water cart.
A water cart contains about 240 liters of water and is usually mounted on a donkey. It is the most reliable means of water supply to households in Wau. The urban water system in Wau covers only a few residential areas, leaving hundreds of households without clean drinking water. A 20-liter container of water is sold for 15 South Sudanese pounds by vendors. Wau Town residents welcome the ban on children from selling water. Speaking in Arabic, Wau resident Pasquina Wadarif says individuals using children should be punished.
If you tell these children to stop doing this, they tell us their situation is bad. So we should blame the owner of the donkey for employing these small children. The child only needs to survive because the situation is bad.
Wau resident Suleiman Barut Mohammed says the nearly 4-year-long conflict has affected children. Speaking in Arabic, he says most children selling water have no other choice.
Some of them, their fathers were killed and their mothers are suffering. What do you think they should do? Instead of going to steal, carrying water is the best they can do.
According to the U.S. State Department of Labor and Bureau of International Labor Affairs, the conflict has continued to impair the government's ability to deliver aid, provide education, and address the worst forms of child labor. More than 1 million primary school-age children are not in school. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Motorists in Juba are outraged over a recent decision by the South Sudan Traffic Police Department requiring drivers to renew their licenses regardless of expiration dates. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
Driving permits and number plates have always been issued by individual states in South Sudan. But this year, national authorities have taken over the registration and issuing of driver's license and car plate numbers. Motorists in Juba say they were not given enough time to register for the new license plate and blame police for not announcing the new changes. Commuter Pony Inosambaraza says police stopped her last week on her way to the office and demanded she present the new driver license.
I have to look for somebody who can drive me with the current driving license. You know, it's actually affecting the community because, you know, they need to pass the information earlier, like maybe 2 months awareness to the community so that people can get ready and then start changing if there's any change to change their driving licenses.
Another motorist, Jaffa Rizik, says his renewed driving license was confiscated by the police. Rizik says he wonders the kind of a government system that exists in South Sudan.
They say that one is the order from their boss, so everybody must change the license to SSD. They are supposed to give us some time. If that license has got to expire, then after that you will change it direct to the SSD.
The cost of a driver's license issued by the former Central Equatoria State government is 4,000 South Sudanese pounds. Brigadier General Daniel Justin Bola, police spokesperson of South Sudan, says the new driving license matches required international standard, so it cannot be forged by criminals. He says the public was made aware of the changes through the media.
Yes, we have asked people to renew and we gave grace period. Sometimes we talk to the people that from this date and this date you can come and renew your license free. And after that you will pay some money. But people, they don't respond. You see, that is the problem.
Bola says the new driving permit costs 5,000 South Sudanese pounds and he urged motorists to cooperate with the new order.
Whenever you pay money for the government, you have to take your receipt. How comes you pay money and then you don't ask for a receipt? Maybe because you are in a hurry and all this. But the law is very clear about this. And if such cases are reported, we apprehend the person and then he will face the law.
Civil society activist Jame David Kolok says the process of getting the new driving permit lacks transparency.
If there is any other law that comes out from the government, and especially in this case, the traffic police, I think the first thing that they ought to do is to ensure that there must be a public information telling citizens that there are changes that are going to take place, whether it is on permit, whether it is on any license, whether it is on logbook, or even on number plate.
It is unclear if the new driver's license will be accepted by the state authorities across South Sudan. South Sudanese motorists have had to change car plate numbers and license several times since the country gained independence in 2011. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Some pointers for journalists and aspiring reporters in conflict zones like South Sudan. Find out more when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which African country do you admire most?
I admire Nigerians. They are very bold and they are go-getters.
I admire DRC Congo because of their music. They perform the best of music ever in Africa. Even though you don't understand what their language, but you admire their music.
I admire Ghana. It's my country, it's my motherland. Moreover, the culture of Ghanaians are unique. We are also very, very hospitable.
I love my country, South Sudan, and I'm so proud of it, despite of the ongoing ups and downs.
I admire Botswana, because Botswana is a good country, is a cool country. You know, they don't have this other corrupt, other things that are happening in other countries. They're like just like Switzerland in Europe, yeah.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday Health segment, and today we are talking about the Madagascar plague. The World Health Organization warns a highly infectious, deadly form of pneumonic plague is spreading rapidly in Madagascar, and quick action is needed to stop it. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Pneumonic plague, which is transmitted from person to person, has been detected in several cities of Madagascar. This worries the World Health Organization as the disease is highly contagious and quickly causes death without treatment. Plague is endemic to Madagascar, resulting in around 400 cases annually. Most are cases of bubonic plague, which is spread by the fleas of rats and other small rodents. The disease is usually confined to rural areas, but this year it has spread to large urban areas and port cities. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says cases of bubonic as well as the human transmissible pneumonic plague have been found in the capital Antananarivo and the port cities of Mayunga and Tuamasina.
So far, 104 cases of plague were reported since first case has been identified that was dating from 23rd of August. So from 23rd of August to 28th September, 104 cases that have been reported, including 20 deaths.
Jazarevich notes the fatality rate is more than 19%. He tells VOA this outbreak is very dangerous and must be brought under control quickly.
The plague epidemic season usually runs from September to April, so we are really at the beginning of the epidemic season of plague, and we already have, so from 23rd of August until yesterday, so it's a little bit, it's like a 5 weeks' time, we had 104 cases, and again, half of those cases were pneumonic plague.
WHO says urgent public health response in terms of surveillance and treatment is required. The health agency has released $250,000 from its emergency fund to get immediate action underway. It plans to appeal for $1.5 million to fully respond to the needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Organizers of the Coalition of Advocates for South Sudan, an umbrella group of South Sudanese nonprofits and activists, met over the weekend in the United States for their third annual conference. This year, the group, which met in the Midwestern city of Des Moines, Iowa, is focused on empowering and equipping South Sudanese leaders in the diaspora to use nonviolent means to end conflict and to build lasting peace, both in their current communities and back home in South Sudan. The coalition's board president, Ruben Garang, says the coalition came together almost 4 years ago at a time when their mother country needed them most.
And we are aiming at using nonviolent means to seek justice, peace, and restore hope among our people, encourage the humanitarian intervention to reach people that needed it. And the goals of the organization is to build a democratic country where all citizens will be treated with respect regardless of which ethnic group they come from.
Ruben, I couldn't help but notice that you let out a heavy sigh as you were speaking. Is that an indication of how you feel about the progress of peace in South Sudan?
You know, as we choose to do peace, it's not easy. We're dealing with a very dire situation where people are killed, where relationship has been destroyed, where hope is lost. So to bring people together and to think about the work that we are doing is sometimes affect us as individuals. But, you know, we still believe that together as the people of South Sudan, coming together and working together beyond our ethnic divide, beyond our zone of comfort, beyond our political affiliation, we will be able to do something positive, and that is to restore hope and peace in our country.
Did the conference come out with any guidelines or any advice for the diaspora and how they can affect change in South Sudan?
There is an outcome that come from the conference. And I just want to mention briefly that we had a conference, but we were also having a training during the conference about how to be effective peace mobilizers and about how to be effective people that could bring communities together. We had a well-known lawyer and well-known mediator and a founder of the Institute for Sustainable Peace, Randy Butler, who taught us that we have to work together regardless of how different differences that we have. We have to work together to make sure that we disagree to agree. The highlight of the conference is that We have to work together regardless of our differences.
But how exactly do we do that? How exactly do we bring people together? You and I both know how strong emotions run and how separated communities are because of the almost four-year conflict. So beyond words, how do we bring people together?
That's why I mentioned the training that we have. There's so many elements built in that training that we have on how to do that. One of the things that we did with this conference is that we invited ethnic leaders, and a good number of them came, and they are committed to go back to their communities. We have to start a dialogue and be honest to one another, saying that, you know, this war has affected all of us. Not one community that is affected, it's all our communities. But we have a responsibility of working together as people of South Sudan, because we know that our politicians have failed us, and if we don't do something as a communities, the politicians are going to continue with the status quo. So for me and for us, I think the most important thing is that we have to accept that we are divided, and we have to acknowledge what happened to each and every community. We don't have to deny that. And from there, we have to initiate how to talk and move forward as a group.
And I noticed in the past, your organization made a point to bring people with different opinions about the conflict and politics in South Sudan. Last year, you had people from the South Sudan embassy, and you also had the opposition.
Yes, we did. And we always tell our people that this forum, it was created to bring people with a different political views and different opinion together. We don't have to run away from each other. We know that there are opposition in our country. We know that there is a government in our country. We know that they are divided politically. We have to bring people together, and we have to do that by bringing the politicians together and our communities together.
That was Ruben Gareng, president of the board of the Coalition of Advocates for South Sudan, speaking to me yesterday from Des Moines, Iowa. A veteran journalist in VOA's English to Africa division, who retired last week after working for 48 years, says he enjoyed covering Africa during his career at VOA. Africa News Tonight's former managing editor, Joe DeCapua, says his favorite moments were when he covered the conflict in West Africa in the 1990s. He says a good journalist must be ready to learn at all times.
I remember sitting at my desk and my phone rang, and Charles Taylor called me, and he was the rebel leader. He wasn't yet president of Liberia. You have to interview some of these folks, and you know that they were killers. You know that they had taken lives, and brutally taken lives. And same thing with what was happening in Sierra Leone when our reporters there, like Kelvin Lewis was one of our reporters there at the time, and how he was captured and held, or how I was on the phone with him as the rebels were coming, and he had to just drop the phone and run. And these were difficult because you knew what the folks were like, yet you had to get the story so that people would know. But
some of these events really were tragic in nature. Do you go home and you're still thinking about these tragedies happening in this country?
You try, and I think this is good for any profession, you try to keep your work life separate from your professional life, but you can't always, right? Especially when you're covering a story, you know how personal it is to get involved in a story. You want to get this story. You keep digging, you dig, and to try to get the facts. And you know your mind doesn't stop working when you get home, so you got to be careful of that it doesn't interfere on your personal life. I personally do not like to interview politicians because, let's face it, John, they don't always tell the truth. Right? They'll no matter what you ask, they'll manage to give you an answer which won't quite answer what you want. So that's why I decided to go more into the health and humanitarian areas.
Reporting,
because
because
I thought maybe you could make a difference there. Sometimes talking to a politician, it may get you some headlines and stuff like that, but I'd rather talk.
It's quite some interesting point you're bringing out here, that you don't like talking to politicians because they don't tell the truth.
Not always. Now, I'm saying all politicians. I don't want all politicians to call me up. But, you know, any good politician or any bad politician knows how to spin a question where you can't quite get the information out. You know, they'll give you the answer that they want to give you.
And so now that you are retiring and you want to go and rest at home
in my rocking chair.
In your rocking chair after many years. What kind of message would you give to aspiring journalists in South Sudan if these are journalists working in a very difficult environment, handling politicians on a daily basis?
First of all, I admire them. Anyone working in a war zone, and I really haven't worked in war zones, they are a special breed of people. I think on the one hand, a war correspondent has to be a little bit crazy and a little bit oblivious to the danger that they're facing. So first of all, I admire them. They do things I can't do. But to any aspiring journalist, and we're doing this interview right after we had a training session with a lot of the folks at VOA, and a lot of young journalists were there. You have to perfect your craft. It's not good for a young journalist, I don't think, to get a big job first starting out and never face adversity, never face tough editors, never face criticism, because that's how you learn. In college, one of my professors was a top official at the Associated Press, and when he gave me back my stories, they were dripping in red ink because he just tore them to pieces. So you have to learn how to have a thick skin. You have to learn how to put your ego aside. I had to learn how to get rid of a New York accent, right? And for those of you who've never been to New York, yeah, you talk like this, and, you know, the word hammer would be hammer. And, so I would send out audition tapes, and they would send them right back saying, you have a New York accent. And I would say, well, what's that? Everyone talks like that. So I had to go to a broadcasting school and spend months relearning how to speak English, how to put G's on ING's and R's on words that ended in R's and take R's off of words that didn't end in R. Mm-hmm. And I would spend hours every night just trying to do that. So any aspiring young journalist out there, put your ego aside, do your homework, train your voice, read out loud every day to build up your vocal apparatus, get your writing, listen to your editors. When, for example, those in South Sudan, when you send your story to John Tanza for editing, watch what he does. Watch what he's telling you. And don't repeat that. You know, don't repeat the same mistake in a sense. Learn from the editing. Don't just take it all. Well, he criticized my work. Put your ego aside.
That's our dear colleague and friend Joe DeCapua, a veteran journalist who just retired from VOA after working at the agency for 26 years. He spoke with John Tanza before his retirement. And that's our show for this Tuesday. We leave you with the song Fatina Yanini by Black Boogie. We've been listening to Black Boogie with the song Fatina Yanini. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. We want to hear your comments about the show. Drop us a line on the web at southsudan@voanews.com or you can find us on our Facebook site at South Sudan in Focus. We hope you can join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Metafly, yeah.